Welcome to the Space Show, Marcus.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, please tell us a little bit about the movie The Living Universe.
So, The Living Universe is a feature documentary that's a kind of spectacular interstellar adventure in search of life outside our solar system. And it's basically, we went out there and asked a number of simple questions to some of the world's leading scientists of how do we find a planet that can support complex life out there? How might we get to that planet? What would we find on an exoplanet? And what will it mean for humanity and science?
For people who perhaps don't listen to our show regularly, what is an exoplanet?
Look, that's a great question. So an exoplanet is a planet outside our solar system. So we have a whole bunch of planets within our solar system, which we've now explored pretty thoroughly. And obviously we're talking about missions to Mars, but we've sent out Voyager 1 and 2 and Cassini. But an exoplanet is a planet that is orbiting around another star or sun. Because, of course, once you've got a planet orbiting around a star, it becomes a sun. And what we've discovered only in the last 20, 30 years is that our Milky Way is actually packed with suns, with planets orbiting around them, and every one of those planets is an exoplanet, which makes it kind of exciting, because until 1995, we actually didn't have any evidence that there were any planets outside our solar system. Which seems extraordinary because, of course, if they'd just read a little bit of science fiction, they would have known that there were planets outside our solar system because, of course, science fiction has put forward the idea and posited the idea that there are planets everywhere, and now we have proof that there are planets everywhere.
Now, what's the genesis of the idea for the film?
The genesis of the idea of the film was actually through Chris Hilton, who is one of the other producers on the project. He had just completed a TV series called Voyage to the Planets, and some of the people that he interviewed in it included Gentry Lee, who is one of the chief engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and Steve Squires, who headed up one of the Mars rover programs. And he asked them, if you could tell a story now, what would you tell a story about in terms of space exploration? And unequivocally, both of them said, exploration of exoplanets. That is the next frontier. We've gone out, done some fantastic work within our solar system, but now it's time to go beyond our solar system. Of course, that presents a pretty immense challenge because clearly it's a long way to the moon, it's a really long way to Mars, it's an unbelievably long way to Pluto. But once you start talking about our nearest exoplanets, particularly ones that might be worth visiting, you're talking in the realm of 5 light-years, and so therefore you're talking in the realm of 240 trillion kilometres. So it's a really, really long way. Really long way.
I used to explain to school children that if we were here on Earth and Pluto was 100 metres away, the nearest star would be in Sydney.
Yeah, it's really great when you take those sort of scale models, if you like, modelling of just how far things are. And look, it's an interesting thing for us because I guess what's happening is our comprehension of the scale of the universe is becoming increasingly sophisticated. And with that, even though 5 light-years seems like an awfully long way when you count it in kilometres, because we've got now an increasingly detailed map of even our own Milky Way, but also other galaxies that surround us, and we're now peering billions of years into the past to be able to see a long way out into the universe, 5 light-years seems kind of like in our neighbourhood, really.
Now, young people often tell me that they don't want to hear about the glory days of Apollo. They need a vision for the future. Now, was that a consideration in deciding the themes for this film?
I think what's really interesting is the Apollo generation, as I kind of describe it, very much we're entranced by the possibility and then the realization of getting to the moon. And then keep in mind that not long after that, very soon after that, we landed a rover on Mars. That was 1977. And we sent out Voyager 1 and 2, which then for the next 50 years, has been delivering, 40 years, has been delivering for us unbelievable revelations about the planets just within our solar system. In terms of the idea of, you know, then casting into the future, certainly one of the things we were aiming to do with the Living Universe, with the movie, was to inspire the next generation and to inspire them with what, for many people who might be, you know, less optimistic, described as impossible. I guess kids don't see those sorts of things as impossible. And so our goal was very much in making the film to go, you know what? Exoplanet exploration is possible. It is possible to get a starship to accelerate to 20% the speed of light. It's not far off. That's something that could be achieved within your lifetime. I mean, if you're 12 years of age right now and you've got a thing for maths and a thing for science, then it's entirely possible. In fact, it easily could happen that by the time you're only 50, you are actually watching the launch of our first interstellar craft.
So you're turning a vision of what most people today would regard as impossible into the, it could be done.
I think there's always been a really important connection between the arts and science. If clearly science fiction feeds off science fact and vice versa, if you don't have those visions, the imagination, been exploring the possibilities of what might be in our future, you don't really provide the avenues, if you like, for those big cognitive leaps to occur. Science requires methodical thinking. You have to work through a set of hypotheticals to arrive at a truth. The arts have this wonderful thing where they can just jump over all of that and go, here is a potential future that we're presenting, and we're not presenting it as a truth, but we're presenting it as a possibility. And what was really interesting about working on The Living Universe as a film was we set up a story world where we had a critical rule within that story world, and that was anything that we talked about in the imaginary journey to the imaginary planet of Minerva B with that imaginary starship had to be within the realm of possibility and plausible science within the next 150 years. And what we were then doing with all the scientists that we spoke to was we were asking them, okay, let's just give ourselves 150 years of development technologically, development in terms of our thinking. What could we get to an exoplanet 5 light-years from Earth? And of course, the answer is yes. Because if you just take the last 150 years, where we've gone from no combustion engine to the combustion engine to rockets, and now we're moving into fusion, and it's only a matter of time before we crack controlled fusion, because clearly we've cracked uncontrolled and rather devastating fusion. Before we crack controlled fusion, and we will have the propulsion technology, if you just look at the idea that 100 years ago, we didn't even know there are other galaxies. We thought everything out there was stars within the Milky Way, and then it's like, oh, hang on a sec, that little spirally thing out there isn't actually a little spirally thing. That is another entire galaxy. And our telescopes, within a matter of the last 20 years, have taken enormous leaps technologically. And so if you imagine that James Webb is about to launch as a telescope, an orbiting telescope, in the next 3 to 4 years, and what it's going to reveal, of course, it's only a matter of time between James Webb and the Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite that's just been launched, TESS, that we're going to have a picture of our nearby solar systems that will reveal planets that have exactly the same signature in terms of atmosphere as Earth. And once we have that, we have a target. And once we have a target, humanity has a pretty good track record in trying to get to places and succeeding.
And what was your role in making the film?
So my role in the film was as a producer, and people say outside the industry, no one knows what a producer does, and inside the industry, no one knows why we do it. So a producer can be many things, but in this particular instance, I was involved in helping with the visualization of how the story could be told across different media. So I was involved in the feature film in the capacity of helping write it and in the edit suite. And when we actually got to the finishing of the feature film, doing all the color grading and the sound. And then I also helped, because we shot the whole film and the companion TV series in 4K, which is ultra high definition. I helped with, which is a new thing for most production companies and post-production houses. I worked out how we were going to actually, you know, physically, technically shoot it and get that finished in 4K so that we could project it on giant screens like an IMAX screen. And then I'm involved with the financing and also now the development of a museum exhibition and the next film being a true IMAX film.
Now, could you remind us about some of the other films that you've been involved in?
Sure. There's a kind of interesting pattern, Andrew, with the films I'm involved in, which they all tend to be adventures. And it's one of those funny things where when I was in my 20s, my wife and I made a TV series that happened to be an adventure film. We never set out to make adventure films, but it just happened to be one. And it was a hit, and it sold all over the world. And from that point on, people have only ever asked me to make adventure films for some reason.
And what was that film?
It was called Africa, Cape Town to Cairo, and it was about a young gentleman travelling from Cape Town all the way to Cairo, hitchhiking, and he was trying to look at the future of Africa through the eyes of the youth. And we were all very young. He was 22, and I was 26, I think, when we made that. And then more recently, I do predominantly feature documentaries. So we did one in 2012 called Storm Surfers 3D. That was about two Australian guys, Tom Carroll, who was twice world champion surfer, and his best mate, Ross Clark-Jones, who are both crazy for surfing giant waves, which sounds crazy in itself, except they're also 50 years old, which is even crazier. And we shot all of that in 3D, and that was very successful. And then just did one also, which I think your listeners would find interesting, that I've just finished and will be releasing next year, about an Australian entrepreneur, David Maiman, who became obsessed as a kid with jetpacks. And he saw Bill Souter fly into the stadium in the 1984 Olympics on his rocket pack, which mesmerized the world. And he went, I want one of them. And then he realized rocket packs actually only flew for 25 seconds. So he set about creating a real jetpack, and we followed him for 10 years as he builds this jetpack and nearly bankrupts and nearly ruins his marriage. And then in the end, he builds it and flies it around the Statue of Liberty successfully and saves his marriage and saves his business. It's a great story.
Now, did you have a prior interest in space before you came to this movie?
I think, like most people, I love science fiction, and I certainly, whenever there was an announcement in the news or in the papers, I'd read the stories about discoveries within our solar system. But to be honest, I knew the difference just between a solar system and a galaxy. I assumed that we'd always know when there were planets out there, because of course science fiction had told us there are planets out there. I certainly didn't know that we had no proof until 1995. So my interest, I think, was about the same as most people's, where there's an inherent fascination, because space and space exploration helps us in a sense comprehend our own place and existence. And we naturally, as humans, pose the question of why are we here, and I think understanding space, not necessarily on a scientific level, but on a more philosophical and existential level, really helps us comprehend our place on Earth. And one of the things I guess I didn't expect in making the film was by the end of 5 years of being deeply embedded in the subject that I would walk out and look up at the night sky and realize, wow, I am in a universe that is alive with life, a truly living universe. And so certainly I now know quite a lot more about space and space exploration.
So what was the aha moment that made you go from making general adventure films to making this specific space one?
Look, I was approached by Chris Hilton, who is one of the other producers, who's a friend, and when he sent me the original treatment in 2013, which I think it was only about 15 pages, I read it, and the natural response was, wow, this subject matter is really meaty. And one of the things that I guess people may not realise, listeners may not realise, is when someone pitches you a film, there's a whole series of questions you have to ask. And one of the first ones is, do I want to work with these people? Because you are going to be working with them for a minimum of 5 to 10 years on a big project like this. This is a big project. The next one is, am I interested enough in the subject matter to spend the next 5 years of my life engaged in this? And if the answer is yes to those two, then you can get down to the more detailed questions of, okay, you know, how are we going to make it, and is it possible, and is there any money to make it, and those sorts of things. So being that I'd worked with Chris a lot before on a number of projects that have been really exciting on all different subject matter, and being that I inherently space is an interesting subject and I didn't know a great deal about it, but thought, wow, I could dive into this. And then when I saw the artwork for the computer graphics and the animation in the film, what's called key art, which is the original designs for the starship and the planet that we go and visit, I was like, oh, well, of course I want to be on board this journey, because who wouldn't want to go and visit a exoplanet and find alien life?
Now, who are some of the real-life experts that we meet in the film?
So what's really exciting in the film is we talk to some of the people who are right at the top of their field, and that includes people like Natalie Batala, who was in charge of the Kepler telescope. That was the first orbiting telescope sent up specifically to look at exoplanets in one part of the sky. We meet Sarah Seeger, who's in charge of the TESS telescope, that is going up to look just for Earth-like planets. I guess the hero of the film in many ways is Gentry Lee, who is 75 years of age and has been involved in landing rovers on Mars and sending out explorers into our solar system for over 50 years. And also Steve Squires, who landed Curiosity on Mars, which is pretty awesome.
You mean Opportunity?
Opportunity, sorry. He landed Opportunity. And then there's other people who are sort of less well-known within the space fraternity, like Karen Oberg, who's doing extraordinary work as an astrobiologist, looking at the birth of solar systems and with the ALMA telescope, which is able to see within a 1 millimeter bandwidth, which is just mind-boggling at that distance, and is discovering that solar systems are born in a kind of bath of complex molecules, which helps us understand the idea that there of other genesis of solar systems having life inherently built into them.
Many films of the sort engage a well-known actor, perhaps as a draw card, to get the audience in. You've chosen people who are, well, in the case of Carl, well-known in Australia, but certainly not outside of Australia, and Tamara. Why did you choose non-professional actors?
So for the narration of the film, we could have easily gone out to well-known Australian actors, but I felt very strongly that the credibility and authenticity of this film is everything. If the film when we take it out, particularly in the education sector, I think I want that sector to immediately see, oh, Dr. Karl Krzyżanicki is the narrator, therefore they mightn't think it through this way, but therefore it's authorised, if you like, by people who are proper scientists. And Professor Tamara Davis, who is the voice of the artificial intelligence that pilots the Starship, that again signals to people that, wow, this film has a real astrophysicist willing to come on board the project, and therefore the veracity of the science in the film is absolute. And also, I think, you know, Dr. Karl had not done narration for a film before, and what the there's an interesting thing where you can get a voiceover done and then you can get narration, and they're two different things, because a voiceover is kind of not meant to interfere. A voiceover is just meant to impart information, whereas narration is a performance. And Dr. Karl imparts information in a way that, of course, is incredibly accessible. And he did that for this film in the way that he narrated it.
Yes, it's very conversational.
Yeah, and it's conversational rather than voice of God. And the voice of God narration works in television where you're not wanting the voiceover to cross over and lead the audience. You're wanting it simply to impart information for the next segment. Whereas in this, we wanted Karl's narration to actually take you on a journey. And because we've got the Starship with artificial intelligence actually talking us through her journey to an exoplanet, which takes 50 years, again, rather than having an actor doing the, or a voiceover artist doing exactly what a artificial intelligence might talk like, I immediately went, why would artificial intelligence sound like a robot? Why would it? I mean, if it's that smart, why wouldn't it just sound like an astrophysicist? Hey, let's get an astrophysicist to do the narration. In effect, it's a casting role, so she acts as the artificial intelligence, Captain Artemis.
Now, we've partly touched on this, but what did you learn in making this film?
In terms of the science or more broadly?
In terms of science first, but more broadly as well.
Look, the clearly what I guess one of the things I do when I'm working in the edit suite on a film like this is I try to imagine my avatar audience person. Who am I making this film for? And I actually try to visualize them. I'll even, if I know somebody, have that person in my mind. And what I had in my mind was my 13-year-old nephew, who's super bright, lives in a country town, tiny little country town of 800 people, goes to the local high school, and is studying space like anybody does all through primary school. And then in high school, the amount that they study about space diminishes rapidly to almost zero. And I think for most of us, particularly if we're 40 plus, we learn about space and we learn about our solar system until year six, and then we never learn about it again. So what I realized was for most of us, our knowledge was kind of trapped at that 12, 13 years of age. So I figured if I could make a film that worked for our understanding of space and space exploration at the point where we were 13, it would work for kids and it would work for adults. But the other level that I have tried to work into the film and imbue in the film is those more complex questions around what will it mean for humanity, science, religion, when we have proof that there is life outside of Earth. Most people on Earth are still, if they're asked, would tell you straight up, I think we're the only people. And in the universe, we're the only living creatures, certainly the only intelligent creatures in the universe. Of course, it's only a matter of time before the statistics alone filter out that we now realise, and we've only known this, so the mainstream population don't know this, that there are 400 billion planets in the Milky Way alone. 80 billion of them are Earth-sized planets. So let's assume that out of 80 billion planets, that 1% Earth-like, that's still 80 million. And then let's assume that 1% of that again have the characteristics of being in the Goldilocks zone, have the right atmospheric conditions, have water. That means there's 8 million planets in the Milky Way. So we're now talking a statistic of 0.0001 or something of the planets in the Milky Way. It's still 8 million planets that could support life. So you'd have to be pretty brave, I believe, to say that, oh, we're alone in the universe when there are trillions of galaxies. Come on. I could go out and buy a lotto ticket and I would have a better chance, you know, of losing than of, you know, of life. So I think for me, the thing that will be profound for humanity and perhaps even a boon for religion, who knows, over the next 50 years will be our realization that we are anything but alone within the universe. And hopefully, because the film is very optimistic, it's very inspirational, that was some of my goals. I didn't want to get caught up in, you know, colonization of other planets because we might destroy our own planet. Forget that. Let's take care of this planet. It's a long way to another planet, so forget trying to get elsewhere. So hopefully it will help us, you know, really treasure and understand and love this planet and hopefully aim for peace as well, because I absolutely believe that spending money on space exploration is a way better way to spend money than spending it on defence. And when you look at defence spending, which in the US is $1 trillion a year, that's $1,000 billion a year, and the total spending on space is about $15 billion. If you just imagine reversing that number for a moment and go, let's just take 1 year off from building weapons, 1 year, and spend it instead on space exploration, what we could achieve as a race, it would be unbelievable. So I hope that my film contributes towards that in some way.
In the 1980s, when the Voyager spacecraft, Voyager 2 in particular, was doing its grand tour of the solar system, someone said to me, she said, I can't work out what's real and what's animation. And that was way back in 1980. Today, computer graphics is so much better, as exemplified in your film. How was your animations done?
So the animation in our film was realised by a company called Fawns that are in Lyon in France, and they were engaged by our co-production partners Zed, who are a Paris-based production company, big production company and distributor, and together Zed and Essential Media raised the finance for the film, and then the French director Vincent Amoureux, who was one of the two directors on the film, he works out of Lyon, and they worked together with Richard Smith, who's an Australian director who's done a lot of work in the area of space, and with the scientists on actually designing the starship and designing the landers and imagining the planet and what the life on that planet might be like. So it was effectively a collaboration between the filmmakers, us as filmmakers, and those scientists. Then the physical animation itself is done in the same way that full visual effects are done. So it's actually full 3D animation rather than 2D animation. So wireframe models are built. So let's just take the Starship, which is, if it was in real life, is about the size of an oil tanker. It's big, and they physically build the model with wireframe, and then the next step in that is to is to actually put a surface on that, which is the very detailed part of it, and then they light it in the same way you'd light anything in a set, and then you do all the moves, so you've rigged it, and now you do the actual physical camera moves and the moves of the Starship in relation to planets and space and so forth. And then you hit render, and all the computers choke, and you wait a really long time for it to render. So the Starship had about 5 million polygons, which is the description of each little surface, like the surface of the eye of a fly, is a polygon. And so it's a very detailed and complex model, which allowed us to then be able to project it on an IMAX screen like we're doing at the moment at the IMAX Theatre here.
which brings us to the point, is should people, I suppose this is pretty obvious, but should people go and see this at IMAX or another cinema, or should they wait for it to come out on DVD or even on their little iPhone? I was on the train this morning watching someone watching a movie, and I thought, oh, he must be missing out on so much by not seeing it in the cinema.
Look, I'd of course, say absolutely. We made this film. We shot it in ultra high definition in 4K, so it could be seen on the big screen. The animation was done, so it could be seen on the big screen. The landscapes we shot in 15 countries are absolutely stunning. And I've seen it on the IMAX screen, and it's really, really exciting as a filmmaker to see something shot in 4K, projected in 4K, looking stunning. It's a big screen experience. That said, I'd, of course, love you to see it there, and then I'd like you to also download it to watch on your mobile and buy the Blu-ray for your dad, who loves everything to do with space. And then I know you've got, you're completely covered, and you can keep watching it as many times as you like. But also, if you've got a big television now, which a lot of people do, have very large, very sophisticated 4K TVs, it will be an exciting experience watching this on a 65-inch TV with surround sound, because it's got a big soundtrack also attached to it.
Okay. Will the Living Universe be seen outside of Australia?
So the Living Universe, as a movie, absolutely will be seen outside of Australia. We're now just in the process of planning a tour through the US and Canada with some of the experts in the film, which will be very exciting. We'll be screening it at cinemas and IMAX cinemas over there, but also at museums, because there's a lot of, there's some big ones like the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. And also it'll be going out in Europe as well, which is really exciting. So, you know, the Living Universe has got a pretty long life ahead of it. But in Australia, in terms of seeing it on the big screen, the window is right now at the IMAX Theatre at the Melbourne Museum.
Thanks for joining us on The Space Show.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Andrew. It's been a lot of fun and really interesting.